This is the IBJ podcast for the week of December the 6th, 2021, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. It has been a disorienting week with the sudden appearance and quick spread of the Omicron variant of COVID-19. Anybody with any illusions that the pandemic in our post-vaccine world would burn itself out, which unfortunately included me, had quite the rude awakening. Life goes on, and some of us are hoping to stay healthy and retire in the next decade or two. But the retirement landscape doesn't stay static either. There are some new developments to consider as we do our best to plan for income after we stop working. For example, the IRS recently increased the limits for contributions to certain retirement plans beginning in 2022. Perhaps of greater significance, the national investment services firm Morningstar has essentially debunked the 4% rule, a widely held rule of thumb for how much income you can count on from your investments without draining your principal. If you are close to retirement and have been using the 4% rule, you might have to seriously downsize your expectations. In uncertain times, I like to check in with IBJ investing columnist Pete the Planner, Pete Dunn. He has some insights into Morningstar's proposed adjustment to the 4% rule and the new retirement plan contribution limits, as well as some advice for investors spooked by the Omicron variant's effect on the stock market so far. Pete very graciously addresses a real-life scenario about a 60-year-old investor, who I know, who wants to cash out of the stock market entirely and immediately. Pete also gives us his take on cryptocurrency as a reliable investing tool. Here's our conversation. As always, I am happy to welcome back to the podcast, Pete Dunn, a.k.a. Pete the Planner. Happy holidays to you. Thank you for making time.
Tis the season to be with the king. I don't know what that means. God. That sounds pretty good. Let's go with it.
I was listening to The Little Drummer Boy with my son the other day, and there's like one line in there about, you know, to be with the king. And he said, that's our name. As if we're not related.
There's not a lot of songs that highlight the importance of being with Peter.
None that played on conventional radio, I'm sure.
No.
So anyway, so it's difficult to figure out where to begin here because there's several news stories in play right now that intersect with investing issues and retirement. But the big one for me, the thing that's causing me the most pain, obviously, is the Omicron, not Omicron, as I've been saying before, Omicron variant of COVID-19. It has got everybody on edge. It has been credited with, I think, 3 pretty big hits to the stock market in just 1 week. For me personally, the greatest impact has been a rise in my overall sense of dread about the pandemic, assuming this is a sign that we're never going to get out from under this thing unless we find a way to vaccinate 5 billion people and that we're just going to get hit with new variants on a regular basis. But that's just me. I wanted to get your take, if there is one, on the impact of Omicron on the market so far. Is there something that we need to do or need to know?
Well, I mean, back in March of 2020, when the pandemic hit the market the first time, we did not know what to expect. But the market, despite the fact that it was pretty ugly that summer, it recovered really quick. And then the next hit with Delta, we sort of took it into consideration. I'm not a predictions guy, yet here's my prediction. I don't think Omicron's going to have a very long-lasting effect on the market, and I hope to not regret that statement. I think sort of uncertainty is priced in to the market. I think that the market kind of doesn't care. The market doesn't care because it's going to find a way to persist. And I think there's no better example of that of the at-home stocks versus the get out and experience life stocks. You know, Zoom and Peloton had their heyday and then they found themselves at the bottom of the barrel as they've fallen in popularity, whereas other things have increased. So you're just going to have the ebbs and flows. I'm certainly, Mason, not being dismissive of this new variant, which is incredibly frustrating, but I don't think it's going to have a huge impact on the market.
Okay. So, I mean, boiled down, my question basically is, do I need to do anything about this? Does my strategy need to change at all right now?
No, but you know, timing wise of when we're having this discussion, I still think the debt ceiling comes into play. The government shutdown comes into play. And then you get to use the worst cliche or idiom of all time, the perfect storm. You get to say, okay, new variant, debt ceiling, government shutdown, all happening at the same time. And that's what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. So you could see the market take a little bit of a light bludgeoning. But I think long term, it's still fine.
Okay, we're skipping ahead a little bit, but that's okay. So, like, speaking of Congress, when we spoke, I think the last time we spoke was in late September. You said you were really interested in seeing how this latest wrestling match in Washington over the debt ceiling would play out, how that would affect the market. So my understanding is the drop dead date, as it were, knock on wood, for raising the debt ceiling is December the 15th. Treasury Secretary Yellen says that if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling by then, the government could run out of money. This potentially leads to a national financial catastrophe. And there are a lot of scenarios under which this could get resolved, or it could plunge into a gorge. I don't know. Do you see anything new in this situation? Is the takeaway, as you said, basically we're going to have a couple of weeks of tumult and then maybe enjoy the rest of the year?
Excellent use of tumult, by the way. I think this is going exactly like I thought it would. And when we talk about situations like this, Mason, the takeaway should always be knowing that rocky times or tumult, as some educated people would say, are possible. They are going to impact the market, but it should not impact how you invest long term. So this is playing out exactly like I thought it would, which is to say Washington has ignored this issue since October. And that's why the tumult, as many people say, will be right around the corner, because as the time begins to run out, then, you know, and I also don't like to be the person that says, then the media starts talking about it, because that seems lazy, but the media will cover it more as we get closer to the deadline. And so this is playing out exactly like I thought it would.
Yeah, the media, if you don't mind me interjecting, has got kind of a problem. There are too many things to focus on right now. If it wasn't for Omicron, I'm sure they'd be all over the debt ceiling.
You know, I'm a member of the media. Although I am an opinion member of the media, a columnist, I don't actually report news. I do think sometimes, certainly what we've seen here is what the news chooses to cover and to what degree and what sort of inflection they put on that news certainly impacts the market more than it used to. Mm-hmm. I don't think 15 years ago you could read the news and expect it to impact the market on a minute by minute, hour by hour basis like it does today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for real. So let me pull back out a little bit, more of a 30,000 foot view. I've got a friend who is almost 60. And he is fed up. I mean, in particular with Congress and this whole debt ceiling thing, but everything else. He's fed up with everything that is uncertain, everything that makes the market act funny. And I think he really is seriously considering pulling out of the market, completely pulling out of the market. He has other investments, but for the stuff that's, you know, invested in the stock market, I think he just wants to make it liquid. I'll just lob that up to you and get your take on how you feel about that.
First, I'd like to note every time you say I have a friend, I always get this sinking suspicion it's a guy named Jason Ming or something like that, you know?
It's not. Even if I tried to mangle his name, people would know who it is.
I know a guy named Chasen Ting. It's just like, anyway, I love this question. I love this idea because, first off, when people think this, the immediate reaction from anyone in the financial world is often to begin to shame them to get them to come in line with conventional thinking. Because conventional thinking is just like, relax, pal, okay? And so shame is often used. You say, well, you don't understand it. And that's a problem. That is a massive problem with the financial industry, is that when someone thinks differently, it turns into this haves and have-nots of financial knowledge. So I will start with that. If your friend, let's call him Gary, okay? If your friend Gary is in this situation and Gary can prove with a financial advisor that he can still have a successful financial outcome by pulling out of the market, if he can prove it on paper, then get out. What's it really matter? If he doesn't want to take the risk and lose sleep, go right ahead. Unfortunately, Mason, that's where this always falls apart, is that someone has these feelings of dread, totally understandable, and they act, but there's no other plan. I mean, their lack of a plan is what kills them. So ultimately what your friend Gary will find likely is that if he were to liquidate his investments and go to cash, that within 7 years or so when he looks to retire, the math doesn't work. And so he's gonna have to make a choice. He either has to delay the day he wants to retire, he's gonna have to retire on less, or he's gonna have to take risks that he is currently not willing to take. And there are really no other options.
Yeah, that was probably my next question. I have another friend whose name is Hamison Ling. And he was curious to know, well, you know, if you did that, what would you do with your money next? I mean, you wouldn't put it under your mattress. I mean, there are other places to put your money, right?
There are. I mean, again, it's you get in the risk reward spectrum. You have the traditional asset classes, asset classes like cash, bonds, equity, real estate, commodities. And these are sort of classic asset classes. And so he could choose from that. I would obviously dissuade him from things like cryptocurrency if he's worried about risk. But even things like commodities, like metals, like gold and silver, while they are stores of value to some degree, they also can have some volatility in them as well. So the answer is he'll likely end up in cash, CDs, maybe fixed annuities, municipal bonds, something like that. That's where people often end up when they get completely spooked and bail out of the market.
Yeah, I feel like I see so many commercials. I guess there's a whole spectrum of ads. I'm probably not even aware that I'm watching about cryptocurrency. When you see those, do your eyes just roll up into the back of your head? I mean, should I, as a dumb investor, care at all about cryptocurrency in your opinion?
I could talk about this all day, and it's primarily because my thoughts have evolved about this. So here's where I currently am. We are in December. This is like our timestamp. Like you and I are off in space and we're doing our space log. December something, 2021. Beat the planet reporting.
Can I be first officer, please?
Yeah. I'm in a couple places. Number one, when I was a young lad, when I was in my early 20s, a long time ago, the version of cryptocurrency that existed then was day trading. Okay, that was the version. I did it. Okay, I did that. So as a 44-year-old now, I can tell you that level of risk and to some degree recklessness and speculation does not exist within me. And I also acknowledge that the new version of that is crypto. So if people do that, I understand why. All of that being said, I think it's a completely unreliable way to build wealth. Will people who invest in it be more wealthy than me? I don't know. I don't care. It's not a contest, but maybe. But I also think you can't rely on that strategy to get the job done. People forget investing is not only about putting your money to work, but according to a reliable strategy. This isn't about just wild make your money go up. It's about work the plan. And there's no working the plan of having something so volatile, whether it's tulips or cryptocurrency or NFTs of your very first podcast. I don't really know, but it's just not for me. I'm not shaming people that do it. And I think 5 out of the 6 reasons people say they love cryptocurrency, I fundamentally disagree with. And the 6th one, I at that point, I'm so tired of the conversation, I just completely dismiss.
You know where I really started thinking about this is when I saw this probably internet ad with Matt Damon. Doing the, you know, kind of stoically walking up toward camera saying, you know, blah, 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 fortune favors the brave. And that really struck me because, you know, I feel like in some alternate universe, Matt Damon and I could be friends and I would trust his advice. But that is like, that just strikes me as being really irresponsible of Matt Damon.
So I'd like all the listeners to go to Twitter right now and go to the IBJ handle. Could Mason and Matt Damon be friends in an alternative universe? And then that way, when you ask me questions about your friend, I'll know you're actually talking about Jason Bourne. It's the friend that has a financial question. I agree with you about that commercial. The first time we saw it, it was like, fortune favors the brave. I was like, Wow, that is aggressive. Again, I think you're going to see tax laws. You're going to see regulation. You're going to see regulation overseas, like in China, that impact this style of investing more than people account for. And it's just not for me, right? I mean, I don't like cottage cheese. I mean, I hate to lose the cottage cheese lobby here as one of the sponsors of this podcast for so many years. But I don't like it, but I also don't have a problem with people who do. However, if people use cottage cheese to be their only means for health and nutrition, then it's going to be a bad idea.
Okay. Well, I need to get on the phone and call the cottage cheese people. So this is probably a good place to take a break while I repair that fence. This is the Abby J Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
Okay, we're back with the IBJ Podcast. My guest is Pete the Planner. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, and I'm mainly concerned for the rest of this podcast about retirement. So recently we learned that the IRS has made some changes to the rules for retirement plans regarding the limits for contributions that will go into effect next year. So tell me if I'm wrong here. This is what I understand. So next year, taxpayers can put an extra $1,000 into their 401k plans. And I guess also the 401b plans. Is that right?
403b.
Sorry, whatever. 403b
plans. 403bs, 457. I mean, it's...
If you've got it, you know it. So it will increase from $19,500 to $20,500. Now, that's if you're 49 years old or younger. You've got you get a little more if you're trying to make up for bad planning if you're 50 or older. Is that right?
$6,000 is called the catch-up contribution. So if you're 50 or older, you can do an additional $6,000.
Okay. Okay. My first question is, what is a 403b plan?
403b is for nonprofits. If you work for a nonprofit, it's a 403b.
Oh. Okay. Okay. So this isn't a huge change. It's $1,000. I'm curious about why the IRS would increase the limit, and why is it so incremental?
Believe it or not, I'm not a cynical person. I'm really not. I think at times columnists are thought to be cynical. I'm not one of those. This is my point of cynicism, though. Like, I think it's very hard to run a government, especially the government of our size, of the United States. But I think this is one of the less thought out approaches to helping people prepare for retirement. So don't get me wrong, I'm going to eventually answer your question, but I must take you on a little bit of a journey. So one of the major issues facing our country is the retirement crisis. And there's a couple ways you can look at the retirement crisis. There's plain and simple that pensions have more or less gone away. There, you can look at it and say Social Security is in deep trouble. You can look at it and say healthcare costs for people as retirees is problematic. And you can go even so far as to say housing costs and utility costs are on the rise, which it makes it harder to be an older person in retirement. So all of those things point to a retirement crisis, and I haven't even mentioned the most important part: people are not putting enough away for retirement to solve all those other issues. So oftentimes you look at your retirement plan through your provider as a way to incentivize you to prepare for the future. And the IRS has a role in that. And the role in that is, what is the maximum amount someone can put in one of these plans without having additional tax implications? And so that's what we're talking about now. It has moved up barely in the last 20 years, barely. So incremental, insignificant. It is also worth noting that there's a lot of criticism around retirement-sponsored or employer-sponsored retirement plans. You think I should know that, given that I'm in the industry, because they have less advantage for people on the lower part of the income scale as they do for the people on the higher point of the income scale. So if we increase the amount that can go into a 401k, Mason, if you're not putting much into your plan, does that help you? No, it doesn't. If you're not putting much into your plan at all, and the limit goes up, it doesn't impact you because you're not putting the max in anyway. If you're putting the max in and it goes up, then it only serves people who have a lot of money. However,
so you're saying that they should be doing something to help people who cannot put that much money away.
They should do both. And what they'll say is we can't do both. Well, you can to some degree, but freezing out the people at the top end is not the answer. I don't like pitting the wealthy versus the not wealthy. I feel like that's a lazy trope. But the idea that we're in a retirement crisis with so much uncertainty and the government is to some degree disincentivizing people from saving the proper amount from retirement, that's problematic to me. I don't know, as someone who maxes out my 401k, it's frustrating that next year I will put $1,000 more away. Am I susceptible to the retirement crisis? You would hope not. I mean, I'd like to think I'm gonna be okay. However, I have to note, not everyone lives in central Indiana where life is incredibly affordable. If I live in an expensive area of the country and I'm maxing out my 401k, it doesn't matter, because I'm not gonna be able to afford to retire. And that's where this just gets absolutely foolish. So needless to say, you don't hear me complain a lot about things when I'm on your show. This is one of those topics that actually frustrates me.
For those of us who can put that extra $1,000 in, I assume that you would ask us to do that.
Yes, and I would also note, the second you hit 50, work your tail off to try to get that additional $500 a month away so you can hit that $6,000 catch-up contribution. I am looking forward to being 50 for two reasons. Number one, then my age won't match my sensibility that I've had since I was 12. And number two, because then I can put the extra catch-up contribution in, which I'm pretty excited about.
Okay. You don't know, but you've guilted me into doing it.
Well, good. Tell Jason Ming, I hope he does it as well.
I just got to figure out a way to tell my wife I'm going to put another $5,000 in.
Telling your spouse that you're going to do something financial. Is this what this is going to turn into, this episode of like, No. You shouldn't exactly tell your spouse you're going to do something?
I understand.
You should have a discussion. And come to that conclusion together.
I retract that verb.
All right.
Well, we will discuss our retirement goals together.
I just want you to avoid the tumult.
Thank you. That's one of my favorite words. Don't mock me.
Oh, it's great.
For having a vocabulary.
Oh, no, I'm jealous.
and also, this seemed kind of random, but the limits on contributions to traditional and Roth IRAs are unchanged at $6,000. Seems like it's so little.
So you want to talk about how this policy is so not thought out. So we talked about people in the lower part of the income scale, people who are not putting away $20,000 a year, that they have to struggle to put away $6,000 a year. Well, that's all they're going to be able to put away in a tax advantage way. And of course, it's very obvious, as the co-host of my radio show has pointed out, it's very obvious why this is. It's because they can't have too many dollars immune from taxation. If you're going, some money has to be taxed. However, I find it diametrically opposed to the crisis that exists within the retirement community.
Speaking of retirement, there's my segue. I want to talk about the 4% rule. And I know you know where I'm going with this. It's a very popular rule of thumb for figuring out how much money your retirement nest egg can safely generate for you every year. I'm just going to go ahead and do a little bit of math here just to explain how this works. So if my nest egg is $1 million, the 4% rule says that I should be able to take 4% or $40,000 out of the nest egg every year without losing any of that $1 million in principal. Is that right?
That is correct.
Is that the idea? I mean, essentially.
More or less, yes.
So my understanding is a lot of people use this rule of thumb to create a target for their nest egg. So I can see that the average Social Security benefit is $1,500 per month. That's about $18,000 per year. I add that to the $40,000 and I can say, hey, if I can get that nest egg to $1 million, I added these numbers, I should almost have $60,000 a year in annual income for retirement, or $5,000 a month. That sounds great. Here's the fly in the ointment. Morningstar, which I think is a pretty well-regarded financial services firm, now says the rule of thumb should be 3.3%. So in my example, that would shave $7,000 a year off what I thought I'd be getting. What are your thoughts on this reduction? I mean, number one, it sounds to me like it's a real bummer for anybody approaching retirement age who use the 4% rule.
It is. I would note the 4% rule is a very helpful rule of thumb. I mean, that's the whole point of a rule of thumb, is just to give people a general guide, a ballpark. We just got to switch the caliber of the measure here. Like, it's got to go to 3.3. We'll call it the Bird rule, the Larry Bird rule, the rule of 3.3.
Wait a second. Was this, I forget, this jersey was 33?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
What do you mean you forget?
Dude, that was so long ago.
Where were you born?
Central Indiana.
What's wrong with you? How do you not know he was number 33?
I was incognito in the basketball until he was playing for the Celtics. I don't watch the Celtics.
Boy. Anyway, despite the sports tumult that exists in your life, I have to tell you, the Bird Rule is how I think of it now. It's 3.3%. And what they should have a person do is to say, am I on track? Does that make sense? What I can't have a person do, though, is you mentioned something, and where people go after they have the same thought as you do is what worries me. You said, well, hey, it's a $7,000 reduction. And so what a lot of people do, and this is anecdotal, a lot of people will say, ah, we'll figure it out. Don't do that. Don't do that. $7,000 for the year is not a rounding error. That's a big problem. That's a huge problem. And so you got to figure it out. You got to go to your financial advisor and ask her to make the numbers work. And the 3.3 is likely what she would use to help you figure it out. Although I have to note, financial planners get a little bit more exact than using, you know, rules of thumb like the Bird Rule.
Now, I know that you think that the realistic nest egg is $500,000. And for that person, the loss of what would be $3,500 from the 4% rule, that's even more significant.
Well, yeah, I mean, to some degree, I think real for the IBJ readership and for the IBJ podcast listener, I think the $1 million nest egg is more likely going to be part of their lives. I think for the average American household, you're more likely to see $500,000 or less. Man, I feel like you could sell advertising on that fact there, right there. But I would say for most people listening right now, $1 million nest egg is probably the bare minimum that you want to do figuring on for inflationary reasons, if nothing else.
Now, do you think that this adjustment for Morningstar seems merited? Do you think that the 3.3 is the better rule?
Yes, absolutely. Because we've had such artificially low interest rates for so long, I think it's hard to generate, you know, guaranteed income's a little strong, repeatable income in that 4% distribution range.
Should I be using the 3.3% rule, or should anybody be planning their retirements by rule of thumb?
I use 3% on my own calculations.
3.0. Yeah,
look, here's the thing. Why miss? So here's the secret of people's financial lives. I'm going to share it with you right now. I mean, you should just tease this for weeks before you release this episode, because this is the secret. When people run up against situations like this of should I run 4% or 3.3 or 3, they run numbers that seem favorable, but for no reason other than to make themselves feel better. Yeah. The goal is to succeed at this, not to make yourself feel good. So why lie to yourself? Like, why create this scenario that is highly unlikely? And people will say, well, because I want to live life now and not save everything for the future. Awesome. We're all adults. You're going to live. You should be conservative and run at 3%. And not because that's what I do, but because that's what I do.
So Morningstar, at least from the public side of their paywall, very briefly explains what's behind this adjustment, saying they looked at estimates for investment performance and inflation. They also talk about, very briefly, about low starting bond yields and equity valuations they think are too high. And I know we can't get into all that. But is this all an indication that the conventional wisdom in the financial planning industry is that we should prepare for generally lower returns than our parents did?
Paywalls, am I right?
Yeah, we have one too. So
I know, I'm just kidding.
They serve a purpose.
So that's why you're able to afford that haircut of yours.
Don't make a joke about something they can't see.
That's the glory of radio. I'm painting.
It looks like a dirty mop, okay? There you go.
I'll just say it looks like you weren't grounded when you touched the refrigerator.
I'm afraid to go to a barber. Is that what you want to hear?
I don't know. All right. So I don't think it's about returns aren't as high as you want. I think it's I'm going to split hairs here. I think it's about how confident you are that those returns are worth betting on, right? So it's worth turning on the faucet of income and saying, I'm going to stop working and rely on my investments to provide income to me. I think people have less confidence that the returns will be reliable, which is slightly different than counting on lower returns. Now, people listening to this that are in the financial world are thinking I'm crazy, and people who are not in the financial world also share that sentiment. I think returns are going to be the same. I just don't think you can structure income based on them because the lower confidence is the issue.
Okay. I'll buy that. Is that the best takeaway from all this business about Morningstar's adjustment?
No, it's not surprising. It's just, you have such low interest rates. I do believe that you've got inflated equity valuations, I mean, big time. And you've got inflation to play into that. So yeah, I think 3.3 is the modern version of the 4% rule.
Well, that's it. Hey, this has been a good one. I probably won't talk to you until after the holidays. So have a good one, all right?
I hope you have a happy holiday. I hope all the listeners have happy holidays, and we'll talk to you in 22.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn for all of his expertise. A couple of quick reminders about Pete that we didn't mention in the interview. One, he does not have any hair. Two, his column on personal finance appears regularly in the print edition of IBJ, and you can find several years' worth of his work at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few other stories in the latest print edition of IBJ I'd like to point out. Number one, Indianapolis is well behind peer cities in terms of land dedicated to parks. The vast majority of forested land in Marion County is privately owned. Leslie Bonicia Muniz explains how the Indiana Forest Alliance is trying to encourage protections for the trees on private land so they're not destroyed by future development, starting with an exhaustive study of forested land in the city. Also in this week's issue, Dave Lindquist digs into the new strategy for creating new restaurant concepts at Fisher's Test Kitchen. And John Russell details plans by Village MD, co-founded by a former Anthem executive, to use more than $5 billion invested by Walgreens to buy primary care practices across the country and open clinics inside of Walgreens pharmacies. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business, community, and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week. $2 for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.